Let me get you, please, in your New Testaments to Philippians chapter 2, please. That'll be a central text for us for our Bible class time, Philippians chapter 2. And while you're getting set there, I just want to say thank you again for getting to be here. I'm thankful to the leaders of this church, the two men who shepherd this group, who've allowed me to come, and for the great encouragement that it's been. I've enjoyed it very, very much. And good to see visitors, friends I've known for some time. And I just love being together with God's people, and I love studying the Word. And thinking about this important topic of grace and how it changes us. And we've tried to categorize it in a way that I believe is consistent with how the New Testament is just consistently asking you to think about this. So I'll just briefly go back through it this morning. We all want to be more holy. Everyone here wants to be more like God in the way you think and live. 1 Peter 1 says, be holy like God is holy. But how do we get there? What's the process by which we do that? Here is what the New Testament is showing us. Everything begins by turning your attention to the Lord and taking in as much as possible of His great grace and mercy and love. That is external, and it's coming towards you from the God of heaven, the limitless giver of good things. Your faith is that internal part of you that takes that information in and is changed by it. The change isn't yet external, it's internal. It's the way you think and the way you feel and the way you understand your life. And then as you change here on the inside, your works change, your life goals change, and the things that you do change. So I mentioned on Friday night, I don't think you should think of faith as a balancing of grace and works. They're not even close to the same size. It's like balancing the sun and the moon. It's a ridiculous comparison. Faith is not the balancing of grace and works. Faith is the processing of one to produce the other. And so I want you to think of yourself as this processing unit. You're taking in all of this overwhelming information. It's doing something inside of you, and it's producing something on the other end. And I mentioned it, I think, in this way, maybe yesterday. It's like a fire hose of just immense, amazing things that comes into you, and it produces this nice little consistent stream of obedience on the backside. We trust, and then we obey. Now, what we're going to do today in the class is continue to talk about faith one more time. We will get to works in the final lesson, but I think Todd and I probably preach a lot on works. We preach a lot on good behavior and godly behavior. I want to talk more this weekend on what has to be happening before that's ever really going to hold. So one more lesson on faith, and here's how I want you to understand it. There are two things that must happen inside of you when you receive God's grace in order to live a more holy life. The first one is you must learn to trust Him. Both of the words start with the letter T, and the first one is trust. I trust what He's saying. I trust His promises. I trust His power. I trust everything about Him, and so I'm going to go out and obey Him. That was yesterday's lesson. But there's something else that has to happen in here as well. Something that is just as important as trust, and it's not going to pay off unless you do this along with it, and it is simply the word transformation. When you take in understanding of God, you ought to fall in love with Him, and He ought to begin to change you from the inside. I dare you to go out there this week and change your output without changing yourself first. When you adjust who you are, how you think, your humility, everything else will change. And so what we're going to do today is talk about what that transformation is. And there's another word that we use in the Bible that may help, and it's the word attitude. Your attitude is that internal part of you that takes in what's happening around you and decides what you're going to do about that. The more I learn about Jesus, the more my attitude ought to be altered. And the Bible talks about it. Are you in Philippians 2? Look at verses 5 through 8. We know this text really, really well. I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, the 1995 edition, and here's how it reads. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although He existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied Himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Let me make this point very clear. If you know that about Jesus, if you know that He altered His state to that grand amount, that He made this ultimate sacrifice for you, you need to trust it, for sure. But you also need to be transformed to emulate it. You see what I'm saying? It's not just, Jesus was humble, I'm so thankful. It's, Jesus was humble, I need to become humble also. That's called transformation. So let's talk a little bit about what Jesus did here. We know this text very well. We know that He was up in heaven and we were down here on earth and you and I were never going to get to heaven. There was no path by which we would ever get to heaven. So Jesus looks down upon us and says, somebody's got to do something. They need to change. I think we would all agree that Jesus should have stayed in heaven, enjoying all the glories of heaven, and you and I should have made all the changes. Would you agree that that's the case? But guess what? We don't know how to do it. We didn't know how to do it at the time, and we would not have done it well. So Jesus said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to alter myself for their benefit. They're the ones that should be changing. Hang on to this. You're going to need it this morning. They're the ones that are wrong. I'm right, Jesus. They're wrong. Guess who should change? They should. Guess who changed? He did. He altered his position, not for his own benefit, but for our benefit. If you want a very simple definition of what humility is, that's a word we use all the time, you know, take the lowly position, you know, have compassion towards others. If you want a great definition of an attitude of humility, it is altering yourself for someone else's benefit, even if they don't deserve it. Even if they're the ones that should be changing. And so when I read this text and I think about Jesus coming down from heaven to earth, but not just to earth, down into human form, down into human persecuted form, down into being crucified on a cross, he altered everything for our benefit. And that's what you and I have to be willing to do if we're going to save souls. If there's going to be unity in the Lord's church, if we're going to carry his will to others, we must be willing to make alterations. Now, I want you to kind of mark this. We need Philippians 2 today. But I want to show you an example of someone else who did exactly this. His name was Paul, and he was very effective in this world. And most towns he walked into, he was right and they were wrong. I would say almost all the time. He walks in, he has the truth, and they don't. But guess who did most of the changing? Most of the altering of his language, his facial expressions, his attitude. He did. Jesus went down below us so he could lift us up. That's what Paul did as well. Let me show it to you in 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Just an example of this that was very consistent in his character and ought to be in ours as well. And sort of the main idea today is if we can start to learn how to make this adjustment in ourselves, we can live far more faithful lives and be better for people around us. Check out the text. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. The Apostle Paul writes, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more." And we're going to pick up on that at the end of the session in a moment. But his ultimate goal was not just to be right. He was already right. His goal was to try to help other people be right who are currently wrong. Do you know anybody like that? I'm going to let you take the high road now. You're right. You know anybody who's not right? Anybody who needs to change and become right? What's your strategy for that? Just point your finger at them like this a lot. Or continue to make your arguments to them. Let me show you what he did. He said, look, I had to become a slave to them so that I could win them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. Now he said it in the text, I won't spend all morning on it, but if he's around sinners, he didn't start sinning to make them more comfortable. He was always subject to the law of God. But in any room he walked in, the idea was, okay, I need to help these people. So can I adjust the words that I use? Can I adjust the tone of my voice? Can I adjust the clothes that I'm wearing? Can I adjust the food that I'm eating? Can I adjust the soapbox issue that I choose to take today? Like, what can I do to adjust me so that when I interact with them, it doesn't push them away, it lifts them up? That's what Jesus did. And ultimately today, if you'll go back to Philippians 2, that's what we need to learn to do. And most of that happens on the inside. If your strategy is to leave here today and go, I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to start adjusting kind of my take for the benefit of my family, for the benefit of others, and you're not really kind of thinking about it much and you're not preparing, you're just going to go wing it when you get in the room, you're in big trouble. Like, these are not the kind of things that happen on the life side of this equation. They still happen on the inside. This is the kind of stuff you pray about. This is the kind of stuff you think through before you walk into the room. How can I change me for their benefit? The problem is we have a ton of pride. I don't know. Maybe you don't. I have a little bit of pride. And it says, if I come in and I make the adjustments, it looks like I'm the one that's wrong. If I come in and I try the different strategy and I'm more merciful and I'm more careful, it looks like I'm the one that's walking on eggshells because I'm on unstable ground. We have this pride in us that goes, if I believe I'm right and they're not right, I'm not changing, they need to change. Can I ask you a quick question? What if Jesus had said that about you? Just think about that. Give me 30 seconds on that. What if Jesus had said, you know what, they're wrong. I'm not going down there and letting them kill me. Are you kidding? They'll figure it out one day. When they do, they know where to find me. Sometimes we're like that with our churches. That's why lack of evangelism is killing churches. Like, they know where to find us when they're ready to admit that we're right. They know where we are. They're not coming, and it might be your fault. Are we ready to go, okay, I think that's probably true, and we can make adjustments. Attitude. Back in our text, you have like verses 3 and 4, and a lot of this has to do with brethren and the way that they interact with each other, and we'll get into that more in the main worship hour, but Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, and that's what I'm telling you today. Most of this happens on the inside. Most of this is preset stuff. But with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude. You say, well, what does that look like? Well, it looks like Jesus. Before Jesus got here, he decided to come here. He had a humility in mind before he ever actually lived out the trail of humility. He said, look, I've got to give this up for their benefit. I want to give this up for their benefit. I'm ready to do this for them. And then he did it. It all starts with our minds. And so I want to give you an illustration today. This is one of my favorite illustrations. I trained for my pilot's license like 25 years ago. There's a story for why I didn't get it. I could tell you later. Someone had an accident. It wasn't me, but I think the women in our lives were like, that's done. You're not doing that anymore. There's the short version. You got the 5-second version on what happened there. But I was training, and I was training in a Cessna 162, which is a little little plane with the two seats. Had this really interesting instructor, very cantankerous older gentleman, very hard on me. But he was training me how to fly, and he said, all right, we got to learn these instruments. And he said, this is probably the most important instrument that you need to learn. Anybody ever seen this or anything like this? Now, if you go try to fly today, there's all kinds of instruments that are digital now, and you probably don't get to see like a real live cool gyroscope. But this was way back in the day when you had two things. Now, I want you to notice that this device is only measuring two things. You and everybody else in the world. That's all it's measuring. You're in the airplane. You in the airplane. It is your orientation with respect to the world in front of you, the horizon, the earth, the ground. You're in the sky, it's on the ground. It has a really cool name. It's called an attitude indicator, which is like so on the nose. It's like, how do you not preach with that illustration? It's called an attitude indicator. But an attitude indicator is trying to help you see, and here's a couple of definitions for it. It's trying to help you see where you are, number one, with respect to where everybody else is. You're having to go, what's my position with respect to the people around me and the life in front of me? And it's also this idea of where you are in relation to where you ought to be. I first read that term, I was studying, it's going to sound all like homeschooly lead or something, but it really wasn't that special. But I was studying like aerospace engineering. Like I read one article, it's not like I went to school for anything. But and you know, here comes this aircraft into our atmosphere. Like this thing is about to interact with the whole earth. And it has to set its attitude. And if it doesn't get its attitude right, what happens? Bursts into flames. If it doesn't get its attitude right, then if it gets its attitude right, then it can enter in and interact very well. And so the definition they used was the second thing. It's where you are in relationship to where you ought to be. Now you can hear an astronaut going, we're fine, the earth is all messed up. We're dead on the money. Well, you're dead something. We're dead on the money, but the world, but the point is like, you're the one, many times, that has to adjust to make it work. Because sometimes, it all just kind of looks like this. Sometimes you're looking at it going, look, me and my family, me and the church where I worship, me and my coworkers, me and this society we live in, it's all off, you know? It's not right, and we're not in the proper place. Well, look, you can argue that all you want. You can Facebook post about it if you want. You can tweet about it. But eventually with an airplane, After you've complained about the world enough, you're going to run out of fuel and you're going to have to actually interact with that world. You can't just stay back and complain about it. You actually have to interact with it. Now, do you know what we call an interaction between an airplane and the world? We like to call it a landing. But what would that require? Proper orientation. On the earth's part? No. On your part. If we look at this and we go, no, look, hey, the world is all off, and I'm telling you, I'm right and they're wrong. Look, you can hold this position all you want, but eventually when the two of these things interact, you're the one that's going to suffer the consequences for that. It's the earth's fault, and I'm the one that dies. Now, here's what's interesting about this. One more thing about this illustration. The way that it's set up, the wings, you see the yellow wings? They're set. They don't move. They're ironclad, made of metal. The thing that's moving is the earth. The gyroscope, the horizon is moving. And I think that's very interesting because I think that's kind of the way we see the world. Like, we're right. This thing is always exactly at the right setting. It's the world that's going like this. And we always have the sense that we're right and the world is wrong. The truth of this is the world's just kind of doing its thing. And you're the one that's making a lot of movements and motions. And so while we kind of defend it and go, look, I'm fine, everything else is wrong, eventually the two of you have to interact. And again, I'm just going to keep bringing you back to this. This is what it looked like from heaven when Jesus looked at us. This is exactly what it looked like. He was perfect, actually perfect. We were totally off axis. Guess who made the adjustments? Are you thankful that he did? That's a little thing we call grace, that Jesus did that. But he didn't just do it so you could go, wow, I mean, you really should have just left us alone. He did it so that we could begin to do it as well. So go with me to Philippians chapter 2 again. This has to do with brethren somewhat, but we'll look at it kind of generically here. Look in verses 1 and 2. In Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, if there is any encouragement in Christ, I'm encouraged by Christ. If there is any consolation of love, I'm loved by Christ. If there is any fellowship of the Spirit, I'm in fellowship with Christ. If there's any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. And then he goes, here's what I mean. It can't be about you. If it's about you, then it can't be about the world around you. If it's about you, then you're not going to change. You're going to say, look, everybody else needs to change. And there's going to be crashes. And there's going to be problems. And I think you understand what I'm saying, and this is why I read 1 Corinthians 9 to be clear. I'm not saying if there's sin in your family, you just ignore it. I'm not saying if there's sin in the church, you just go ahead and sin too so that we all can orientate well. Paul didn't do that, and I'm not telling you to do that. But what I am saying is, if you're right and they're wrong, chances are you're the one that's going to have to make changes so that you can get down beneath them. That doesn't sound like any fun. So that from here you might be able to lift them up to a better place. That's what Jesus did for you, and that's what we have to do for each other. Can I tell you that that is very, very, very difficult? I'll give you a quick story. Someone in our family several years ago fell away from the faith, and I did not handle that very well. I was so disappointed and discouraged that I just became kind of mean. I became rude. We would see them at holidays. I wouldn't even look at them. I didn't even want them to be there. I didn't want to be there. And you know why I was doing that, right? Because I was right and they were wrong. So I use that as some justification to just stay up here and go, hey, you know what? I'm right, you're wrong. And all I was really doing was exhibiting, well, I'll go back to verse 1, no encouragement, no consolation, no affection, no compassion, but I was right. And that's all that mattered, right? Wrong. I remember the day it hit me that I was totally dead wrong about this. I'm not saying his falling away was right. You guys understand what I'm saying, right? I'm not saying his sinful life is right. I'm saying I was wrong by promoting myself in that way. So I asked him if he would meet me for lunch, and he agreed, and we went to lunch, and he was still not living the right kind of life, and I just said, hey, you know how I feel about your life. Let's not talk about it, but I'm just here to apologize. I am sorry for my attitude. I'm sorry for my meanness, for my coldness. I am sorry. And what he was supposed to say was, you know, I'm sorry too. Let's hug. He did not do that. He took that knife that I had pushed into myself, and he grabbed it and he started twisting on it. You're right. You have not been kind. You have not been Christian-like. And of course, what did I want to do? I want to go, whoa, back it up. Just remember, I'm right and you're wrong. I mean, you know you want it. I wanted to do that so bad. I wanted to go, no, forget this. Forget this. I want to get back up here. I just sort of took it, and it hurt. It hurt. It hurt a lot. But you know what? A few years later, he came back to the Lord. And one of the reasons I went to him originally was I thought if he ever comes back to the Lord, I'm the last person in the world he's going to call. That's what really hit me hard. I'm like, he would call everybody on the planet before he would call me. And later, when he came back, I was one of the people that he called. That was important. You know, it reminds me of Matthew 18, where Jesus was trying to get his apostles in the right frame of heart. And one of the things he was always trying to get them to do is be humble. So he brings the child and sits the child on his knee in Matthew 18. And the language in the New American Standard says, you need to be converted to be like a child. Why would you tell a saved person they need to be converted? We go, no, it's the world that needs to be converted. The world is off. They need to be converted. Well, you know what? The world does need to be converted from out to in, but they may not be able to go out to in unless you go top to bottom. It turns out with my family member, I needed to be converted this direction before he could be converted this direction. That's what Jesus did for me, and that's what I want to do for others. So as we go back to our text, I'm going to show you a couple things here in Philippians 2 on this. Philippians 2. You say, okay, that's how I want this to go. I want this to go just like that, and we'll get to verses 14 and following in a minute. I want it to go just so how? How do I? That's hard for me. It's hard for me because of, you know, pride. It's hard for me because of scar tissue. It's hard for me because in the end, you know, it's the world is full of sin. Let me give you some things that can really, really help, but they're not external. They're not do this differently. They're all to do with what you're doing in here, how you're thinking and feeling. If we get our faith right, our life will be fine. Our life will follow. And it's found here in a beautiful little verse in Philippians chapter 2. Are you ready for it? In verse 14. Pretty easy. Here's what we're going to work on. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. That's it. That's all I brought. That's all I got. Do all things. All things. All things. Everything. Everything. Go to worship. Go home. Go to work. Be alone. Be with others. Do all things. Do everything. In all things, do them, having determined that there are two qualities that you refuse to carry with you into those things. And those two things are grumbling or disputing. But these are interesting words. They're actually a little bit more fascinating than they look because they almost kind of look external. Like grumbling is a thing that you would go out and do. Or disputing is a thing that you would go out and do. But we're not actually even talking yet about what you go out and do. And these two words are going to show this to you. Let me show you a couple of things. The word for grumbling here, and if you have a different version, it may be translated better than the word grumbling. But it's a murmur or a muttering, a secret debate not openly avowed. It's an internal small circle thing. It's the heart behind what we do. In other words, most grumbling out there starts because of all the grumbling that's going on in here. When you're by yourself, before you get to work, before you get home, before you get to church, the grumbling is happening in here. I'm murmuring. I'm complaining. I'm upset about something. If that's the way the airplane is flying, it hasn't reached anyone yet. But when it does, there's going to be a flaming fireball. But you see, it didn't happen there. It happened in the car on the way there. It happened in the morning while you were praying. One of the things God's people have to commit to doing is not being sour or negative or judgmental about everyone, like we know everything, or unkind. We have to be people who aren't complaining about everything. You say, well, I struggle with that. I struggle with that in my heart. Okay, I'm going to test you guys to see if you know what I'm going to say next. Our series has been grace to faith to life. Like, you know what? I have a lot of bitterness out there. I say, okay, this is what our class is about. Let's start working on this then. We got to get your faith transformed. We have to start rooting out that negativity and sour thinking and bitterness out of here. But you're going, I don't know how to get it out of here. I'm a grumbler. I'm a complainer. I see the bad side of everything. What am I going to tell you to do? Remember, when it comes to grace, to faith, to life, whichever one you're struggling with, just look to the one before it. If you're struggling with the life, let's work on the faith. If you're struggling with the faith, then let's turn our attention back to the Lord. What if Jesus had listed his complaints and grumblings about us before he decided to come here? What if when you went down in the waters of baptism and Jesus is supposed to meet you there, he's supposed to come meet you there. He meets you there. That's pretty amazing that he does that. But before he decided to come meet you there, he thought he would just sort of look at all the things he didn't like about you. All the things you'd done to hurt him. All the reasons why you don't deserve for him to show up. And if he'd have done that, guess what would have happened? He would have never showed up. You'd have come up out of that water thinking you had him and you would not have had him. He continues to look away from that which he could murmur about and mutter about and be negative and sour and judgmental about. He continues to look past those things to try to help you be better. We have to do the exact same thing. The second word is like it. This version says disputing, which again sounds very external, like you go out and dispute. But really, that's not what the word means. It's used all over the New Testament, and it's often translated in a very different way. It's translated inward reasoning, deliberating within and questioning. It's translated my opinions, my motives, my thoughts. And that's what I really want you to see in this lesson. We're talking about the processing unit, not the product of the processing unit. What are your opinions about other people? What are your motives when it comes to interacting with other people? What are your thoughts about your role in their lives? If you're not thinking through those things, chances are your relationships aren't going very well. Chances are your evangelism is not going very well. If you ever go and try to evangelize with anyone, maybe somebody who's walked away from the church you're trying to bring back, or somebody you're trying to introduce the truth to for the very first time, someone you're just trying to help through a tough time in their life, if you go out and try to help someone and they even momentarily perceive that you believe you're here and they're here, you're finished. Nobody's going to listen to some Christian come up to them from this position, telling them that they need to just basically become more like me would be great. Everything would be fine. You don't really even want that anyway, do you? It's kind of an interesting thing. We have to decide ahead of time. My opinions, my motives, my thoughts, my intention is to be humble. My intention is not to argue, not to fight, not to question, not to find reasons to disqualify people. Aren't you glad God's a qualifier, not a disqualifier? I want to be someone internally who seeks to qualify. I want to be like Jesus. And so what I'd invite you to do on your own, in prayer, in the morning, in the car, on the way to work, before the plane touches the ground, what I would encourage you very much to do is make the determination to do all things without grumbling or disputing and settle that within you. And the beautiful thing about settling within you is you get to pray about it. You get to go, Lord, change my heart, change my attitude, change the way I see things, change the way that I am, and let me source everything in God. I'll give you a couple of examples. I'll give you one that's today, actually. So I've had a great weekend. I've enjoyed really being here, kind of poured myself out. This is what I love to do. I love to give everything I got. It's my favorite thing in the world to do. I'm going to get done here in a couple of hours. And not a couple hours. It's a lot shorter than that. But we'll get down here in a little bit. And when we get done, I'm going to go have a great lunch with some folks here. And then I'm driving 6 hours home, 5.5 hours home. And you guys think I'm probably going to be a little bit tired when I get there. I think I'll probably be a little bit tired. I don't sleep as well. Bed was great. Zubers are great. I just don't sleep real well when I'm gone. What do I want to do when I get home? I want to go sit down on the couch and watch Shark Tank with my kids. That's our thing. We've seen every Shark Tank episode. I have no idea why. We're not even entrepreneurs. I just want to sit there and just do. But there are going to be 40 people at my house when I get home tonight. 40. One of our good friends, it's his 50th birthday party, and they decided to have it at our house tonight after church. It's a long story, but that's the end of it. And I'm thinking about, you know, like having a really long lunch here today. and maybe like stopping at Starbucks on the way home, getting one of those little medicine ball drinks and just sort of like building a sermon or something. And you're showing up about 10 p.m. If there's anybody there still at 10 p.m., we're just going to run them out of there. It's a mild example, but I've got 6 hours on the way home to get like myself right about that. I actually love Randall very much. He's turning 50. Yeah, I'm tired. So what? Guess who else is? Everybody. We all are. I've got to adjust in a way that when I walk in that room, I've already gotten rid of this. But if I'm grumbling about it and complaining about it and negative about it, 6 hour drive, all the way up to the door, squeeze the doorknob really tight and open it and then just put a smile on my face, it's too late. Plane's going to crash. I'm going to say something. I got this little thing in my back pocket called sarcasm that I try to keep hidden back there under lock and key. But when my heart's not right, it comes flying out and causes all kinds of trouble. Like, this is the kind of process. More seriously, gentlemen, when you get home from a hard day at work or when you're about to make a phone call to someone that you've had a lot of trouble with in your life and you keep approaching it the same way and it keeps not working. Well, duh, because you keep approaching it the same way and it keeps not working. How about working on your thinking? And again, as the Bible is so full of, we don't have a lot of time here, but as the Bible is just so consistent about, all you really have to do is look back at the mercies of the Lord, the grace of God, His kindness towards you, the case He could be mounting against you since you got out of bed this morning, and the fact that He will not do that because He loves you, and then just transform your heart to go do likewise. A couple of final thoughts here. Verses 14 through 16. I want to draw just three basic takeaways here, and they're all right here in the text. You might find them interesting. It says, verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in this world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. It's a beautiful little text about mission. And the first thing is not specifically noted there, but I want to begin with it just to get you thinking in the right way. And I think we've already talked about this at pretty great length. But all of this starts in your heart. It starts in the cockpit a half a mile before you get to the runway. It starts in the way you choose to think, you choose to feel, you choose to pray. It starts very early. It starts with deciding, I am a person of love before you have the opportunity to love. I am a person of compassion, verse 1. I am a person of affection. I am trying to be like Jesus. But again, this happens before you get to the run. Don't wait till you get there in order to do it. Because in the end, when the Lord comes back, He's going to be reading hearts, not just interactions. He's going to be reading the way that you think and feel and live and move. And if you preset it in your heart to be a certain way, you can make adjustments along the way. I'll tell you a quick story about flying. They put me up to solo fly on like my eighth hour. I've been in an airplane. I don't know what they just probably trying to get rid of me, I guess. But so I go up and my job is simple. Take off, go around, go out like however, I forget now, 400 yards out or something. Set up your alignment and land the plane. Well, I went like a mile out because I was scared to death. And I wanted to make sure I had my plane lined up dead on that runway as far out as possible. And I got it preset, okay, and everything was going great. And that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, hey, preset it. But then some birds started coming from the side like this. You guys, anybody ever flown? You know what you're supposed to do when birds come? Their brains are about that big. You're just supposed to be bigger than that. So they're not going to stop. And you need to move. But I didn't want to move because I was preset. And I had it set. And I had things how I wanted. So I kept going. And the birds didn't move. And I struck one of those birds. You know, there's like a 20% chance you do damage to an airplane when you have a bird strike, and a certain percentage of those actually crash the plane. Like, I put my own life in danger holding my line in just what it was. And I landed the plane. I was so proud of myself, and I walked up to that older guy. I was like, you're going to love this. Like, you're going to love this. My first time up, and some birds came out of nowhere, and I didn't move a muscle. And it was his plane, berated me, cut my shirt off. That actually had to do with the first solo. He wasn't mad at me when he cut my shirt off. It was one of those really nice, like, 1990 OP shirts. Anyway. But he was so upset. He said, look, it's good to preset. But remember, that preset is not setting concrete to the detriment of a changing environment. Sometimes you preset, but you also have to do so in a way that can also make movements. And that's what I think heart is about. Heart isn't about just going, this is the way I'm going in the house, and this is how I'm going to do it no matter what happens. And you get in the house, and there's like birds flying in from everywhere. And you're just going to hold the way that you did it. Well, a good heart also has to be soft and kind and listening and reading the situation and ready to make changes that the situation demands. So we're not talking about setting the course correctly and then holding it. We're talking about setting the course softly and kindly and being ready to hold it because the Lord is looking for heart in us. Here's a second thing. Don't forget the mission. What's the mission? I mentioned to you guys the other day, if the mission is to get to heaven, let's just go. I mean, if you're saved, what are you still doing here? What do you think's going on here? We're here for a reason. That reason is so that we can help other people get to heaven. Do you understand that, right? When you pray for better health, if you're you know, in a catastrophic health situation, you pray, Lord, give me more life, I would advise that you say, Lord, give me more life so I can go and do your work. Because if it's like, give me more life so I can watch the, you know, I mentioned the Astros, I love them, I can watch them win again, like, we're here for something more than that. I want you to understand, your mission is to help people. And the text says that. It says, look, we want to prove ourselves blameless and innocent, which I think is very much about the heart. Blameless and innocent from the heart. Children of God above reproach in the midst of, I get it, the generation is crooked and perverse, got it. Among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life. We are trying to be aligned to what is right in a misaligned world. We are trying to be lights in this world. We are trying to draw people to truth. So we don't change our alignment to match the sinful world, but we change our orientation to help change that sinful world. And again, it's not pointing down, asking them to become like me. It's getting down below them and loving them and being interested in them and bringing them up. 2 Timothy, I know I only have a couple minutes, but it's my favorite text in the whole world, I think, about this topic of why we're here. 2 Timothy chapter 2, love verses 20 through 26. Just want to show it to you for a moment because it reminds us of why I would make these changes. Because if I don't love other people and I'm not interested in helping other Christians get stronger and I'm not interested in helping my family know the Lord or my coworker get in Christ, then you're not going to do anything from this sermon. I mean, it'll be gone in a week. But if you continue to remember that you're here for a more important purpose, you may do amazing things, crazy things. You may give up lustful passions, verse 22. You may pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace. You may stop arguing with everybody about everything, verse 23. You know, foolish speculations, ignorant ones, because all those things do is produce quarrels. I remember during pandemic times, all the arguments and the things we fought over, and you could go to Google page 3 to make your argument, and I could go to Google page 7 and refute it. Like, there was always some article somewhere, some angle. If we wanted to fight, there were plenty of bullets in the gun. But what if it's not God's plan that we just try to win over each other? What if the plan isn't for you to go out and win a bunch of arguments? What if it's not about foolish or ignorant speculations, things that don't have to do with heaven? What if the Lord's bondservants are not quarrelsome? They're not quarrelsome mates. They're not quarrelsome brethren. They're not quarrelsome neighbors. What if we're kind to everyone? What if we're able and positioning ourselves to teach everyone? What if when they do wrong to us and we're ready to do something about that, we choose to be patient anyway? You know, kind of like Jesus has done. What if we're gentle? So even when we have to correct, and there's some correction to this, we're not talking about just accepting people in their sin. We're talking about correcting, but what if there's gentleness in correction? Correcting those who are in opposition. Because perhaps, and here's what I want to do, perhaps God may grant that person repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and maybe that person will come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been held captive by their will. What if I'm making all of my alterations to help free them from the snare of the devil? Please remember, your mission is to help people just like Jesus was. But you've got to decide that in your heart if it's going to exist in your life. And then last thing here, and we're finished. Thank you guys for your patience in this study. Philippians chapter 2, verses 14, 15, and 16. Done with the grumbling, the internal turmoil and disputing. Grace is going to help me with that. I want to be blameless and innocent in heart, soft in heart, loving in heart. I want to be above reproach because I'm hoping that I can help people find God. And then he finishes with this in verse 16, holding fast the word of life so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. Just one final thought for you. Jesus is coming back. There is a day of Christ. The Christ who altered Philippians 2 his entire life to come and get below you and lift you up is also coming back again to see how you're doing. And I think what we need to remember about that is that The humble king is coming. He is a humble king, and he is coming. And the last two things are, he's going to want us to hold fast to the word. But remember, the word's going to start its measuring where? Where's the word going to start measuring you? In your church attendance. Now, it's going to measure your heart. If that heart's right, it's going to be reflected in your worship. But it's going to start with your heart. It's going to measure your heart, and he's going to see how that heart turned into worship and faithfulness. The question is, will I be like Jesus when he comes? And that's the thing that has really worked me over and over again in this study on attitude. I've got 100 excuses why someone else should change and not me. When I complain and you ask me why I was complaining, I can give you 97 reasons why I'm complaining. There's 100 reasons I'm complaining. They're all good ones. But what really humbles me is to think that one day Jesus is going to come back, and he's not just looking for people who are doing the right things. I mean, he does want you to do the right things, but it can be just these boxes that we check. And actually, there can even be a puffed up pride about it, which is the devil's always at work. But when the Lord's coming back, he's not just looking for people who are doing the right things. He's looking for people like him. I'm looking for people like me, who love like me, who think like me, who alter themselves for the benefit of others like me, who are patient and gentle like me. The question this morning is, are you like Jesus? And that's going to start here. Now, what's that going to look like when we get out our doors here in a little bit? That's what our sermon's about. That's what we're going to finish this thing with. But I hope that you'll be thinking about and praying about being more like Jesus from the heart. Thank you, guys.